Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the election of Barack Obama tell us about the relationship between race and politics in America today? And how are the newest generation of African-American political luminaries different from the men and women who blazed their trail? Washington Week moderator and editor Gwen Ifill explores these questions and looks toward the future in her new book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Gwen, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
I'm going to start by asking you to define breakthrough politician, because surely African-American leaders obviously have been knocking down barriers for decades now, but this is a different thing.
It feels different. I have to say, I had to figure out what the definition was myself when I started working on this book. And what had caught my eye was I was coming across so many youngish, which is to say in their 40s, 50s tops, politicians who were walking through the doors that their parents had opened. They weren't protesting. They didn't have to sit in at lunch counters. They didn't have to do the things that traditional civil rights leaders had done in order to break through. These were folks who had Ivy League degrees. These were folks who could have made a lot of money on Wall Street or other kinds of ways, or as lawyers. Many of them went to Harvard and other Ivy League institutions, but they chose public service instead. And they did it in a way that wasn't available to an earlier generation. So I thought to myself, maybe this is actually the breakthrough that their parents had hoped for.
Yeah, you write that these young leaders grew up shaped by access rather than denial, mm-hmm. which is an extraordinary thing, but it's also quite a chasm culturally between them and their elders politically.
Yeah, and it's played out in good old-fashioned politics. I mean, a lot of their elders are people who don't quite get who these young folks are and why they don't speak more specifically to race issues, why race isn't a more explicit driver in their ambition, because that's what they had to do to break through, the elders. The younger generation looks at this and says, well, yeah, okay, I respect what you did. It was important that you marched in that march. It was important that you preached that sermon. But I'm not a preacher and I'm not a marcher. Instead, what I'm trying to do is use the laws which are now on the books, Voting Rights Act, public accommodations protections, and using that as a way of not only helping people of our community, but also reaching beyond that and using it as a way of speaking to everyone. For instance, if black people are disproportionately affected by lack of access to health care, the solution among the younger generation is to say, let's get education, access to health care for everyone, and black people will disproportionately benefit, whereas the older generation may have said, let's picket the hospital.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very interesting to look at the history of this, in that this is not a brand new phenomenon, this sort of tension. Even Shirley Chisholm was sort of called on the carpet by some of the people who had come before her for taking on more than people felt like she ought to.
Shirley Chisholm, who ran for president before anybody, I remember wearing a Shirley Chisholm button as a little girl at one point. She ran for president and had a remarkable lack of support from the black community. Part of it is because the black community at the time that she was in Congress was dominated so much by men who looked at her and wanted to know what the heck she thought she was doing. So she always felt that gender was a greater pressure on her in many ways than race.
You know, Gwen, civil rights activists catalyzed this extraordinary progress. They endured all these hardships in order to fulfill this dream they had. And yet, in this last election, they were so often the most prominent voices telling us they never thought they would see the day.
Yeah, there was a lot going on. There were some civil rights organizers who thought, this is never going to happen. We're not ready. The country's not ready. There were some who said, you know what? We've got to get on board. This is our big chance. Let's ride this wave. But there was a lot of confusion, as always happens when power shifts hands, whether it's power within the civil rights community or the definition of what civil rights is, or whether it's whites handing off to blacks or Italians handing off to Jews in different places. Whatever it is, when power shifts hands and someone steps up and takes it, the first response from the person who's already in power is, who are you, what are you doing, and who invited you to this party? I didn't give you permission. It's not your turn. In each case, these breakthrough candidates had to go ahead and run even when it wasn't their turn.
Well, it's interesting in that the old guard had to be the ones to break through in the first place, and they were the ones whose turn it wasn't, and they had to sort of band together. And I suppose it makes sense that it's still hard to turn back around and hand over control to someone else that you don't fully understand.
One of the best examples of this is John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, who was a lieutenant for Martin Luther King, marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, and is known and widely admired as an icon of the civil rights movement. now a multiple-term member of Congress, but he was 23 years old when he stood at the Lincoln Memorial next to King during the I Have a Dream speech. And for the first part of the campaign, he supported Hillary Clinton because of loyalty to the Clintons. He had known the Clintons. He was friends with them. But halfway through that primary process, he looked around and began to feel like history was passing him by and that he was on the wrong side. He felt so strongly about that that he switched and decided to support Barack Obama, not coincidentally, after his own home district in Atlanta had gone overwhelmingly for Obama. I mean, he's a politician at his root as well and understood what the numbers said, but more important, he understood where at least he felt things were going and that he just couldn't afford to be counted out.
A lot of people have looked at the Obama candidacy and talked about his what's been called a race-neutral strategy. Was there a point at which he consciously decided this, or was this just is this the way his generation is doing things?
I don't know if he consciously decided it. I think Barack Obama is a very smart politician. When he ran for Congress the first time against Bobby Rush in Chicago and lost, he remembered very clearly that one of the reasons he lost is because Bobby Rush said, "Who is this guy?" and painted him as an outsider, an interloper who wasn't really that black. And this was in running in a district which was majority black, and he didn't win, and he studied very well the things he did right and the things he did wrong. When he ran for Senate, however, he got elected because he built a broader coalition. He reached downstate in Illinois and to Chicago and to the Chicago suburbs, and managed to get people who didn't look like him, didn't identify with him particularly, to vote for him. He was then so when he came was time to run for president, he thought, let's work on the formula that works. The formula that worked for him was to broaden who he was, not to be race neutral so much, because I think his thinking was, everybody looks at me and they know I'm black, so I don't feel the need to tell them this. I don't need to beat it to death. But in order to get people to vote for you who do not see you as like themselves, you have to do what you can to minimize the difference between you. And that's what he did.
How are other breakthrough politicians, and you profile several in the book, Deval Patrick and Arthur Davis and Cory Booker, how are they winning black voters specifically? Or is it not a specific thing anymore?
It's not. Well, it is a specific thing. There's a lot of race pride that comes with the black vote. But in almost in every case, including these three and others I talked to in the book, they always said that the first thing they had to overcome was the barrier of who they were as black people. Black voters almost always ask the question, are you black enough? And then what they meant by that, I talked to a lot of people about that question because it seems kind of absurd on its face. And it's something that white people never mentioned, but black people always did. And so the translation turns out to be, are you on our side? Will you sell us out once you get to the big show? And so once people are satisfied that the candidate they're voting for is not a sellout, is someone who does see their race as a positive thing, then they begin to say, okay, all things being equal, I would like to support you. So you have to lock down your base first, but it can't end there. And that's what these breakthrough politicians have in common as well.
Could the Obama candidacy have worked before now? If he had come to prominence and been the age he is now and used the same approach that he used in 2008, if he'd been around in 92, could he have beaten Bill Clinton?
It's a good question. I think that everything happens in its own time, and he would not have been ready. There would not have been a Barack Obama. We're all an accumulation of our experiences, and a Barack Obama was not ready, and Bill Clinton was different. Bill Clinton was an incredible change candidate himself in 1992. People forget that's how he got elected. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow, running against an unpopular president. So in many ways, Barack Obama was only possible because of what Bill Clinton had established in 1992. So they all build on what has gone before. I guess the question for the purposes of the thesis of this book is whether he would have been able to do this if Jesse Jackson had not run. And I would argue that it would have been tougher. Jesse Jackson, when he ran twice for president in 1984 and 1988, was able to knock down quite a few barriers as well. Not enough to get elected, but enough to have people consider, a lot of people, 13 contests he won in 1988, consider the possibility and crossing racial lines because he got a lot of white votes too. That, when that was possible, that made Barack Obama possible some years later.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting to remember that a lot of other things had to fall into place before Barack Obama could be elected.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
What is the significance of the Obama election for American culture beyond politics? In other words, how does this change the way we look at ourselves and the way we live in this country?
It's a very good question, and I don't think we know the answer yet. there is a big difference. I detected on the mall last week during the inauguration an immense amount of self-pride and satisfaction that the United States was able to make this leap, not only among people who supported Barack Obama, but among people who didn't even vote for him. They felt pretty good about themselves. And so there's that. There's also the idea that culturally, I think we came along faster in terms of getting past race in some ways than we did politically. In music, in television shows, Oprah, Bill Cosby, Denzel Washington, more popular than Tom Hanks. When you look at that broader idea of how America has begun to embrace different bits of its culture, you know, white kids singing along to rap music, you understand that we had really come a great distance in all these other ways, and politics, in the end, was the lagging indicator.
Gwen Ifill is my guest. She's moderator and editor of PBS's Washington Week. Her new book is called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. We will be back in just a moment to our discussion with Gwen. You can join us there at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Right now, we would love for you to pick up the phone and dial that other number that we mention so often this time of year, 1-800-456-5372. Jeff Whittington is here, senior producer of Think. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Chris, and hello to you. Thanks so much for tuning into the show today. What a treat for us, and I'm sure for you, to have Gwen Ifill as our guest on the show today on the first full weekday of our membership campaign. We thank Gwen very much for her patience, and we are really, though, thrilled to have her as our guest. And I know I've already received some emails from a few of you saying, wow, Gwen Ifill on the show? Wow, that's great. I can't wait to hear it. Well, we'd love to hear from you right now at 800-456-5372. We are offering Gwen's new book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. It's available when you join the station with our thanks. If you join at the $120 membership level or above, if you would like to get two copies and give one to a friend, you can also pledge at the $20 a month level. That's $240, and we'll be happy to send you two copies of the book.
If you are planning to get the book anyway and you are planning to support KERA anyway, it's a great way to put those two things together. It's our pleasure to be able to do this for you. The book is a fascinating read, and again, we're very excited to be able to talk to Gwen Ifill this hour. You'll have a chance to talk to her yourself in a little bit. Right now, though, please pick up the phone and call 1-800-456-5372. One thing about this show, it's called Think, but we work very hard never to tell you what to think. Our guests don't typically tell you what to think. They tell you what they're thinking and how they think. I think how is probably the most interesting. How and why are the two most interesting questions.
Yeah, and that's the how and why of public radio and public broadcasting is, look, we do this for you. This station, this programming, the news and information you get from NPR, from KERA, from PRI and American Public Media, and even on the television side, it's all done in service of the audience. That is the guiding principle of public broadcasting. Why? Because it's necessary. In order to have an independent, unbiased, balanced, and really deep coverage of news and information, events, current affairs, politics, you really do need a service that is not beholden to advertisers, not beholden to sponsors, that is only beholden to you. And then back to the how, well, that's why we're asking you right now to call 1-800-456-5372. Over half the money to pay the bills here at KERA comes directly from listener contributions. You're a listener. Why not join the station right now at 1-800-456-KERA? And we're not selling you Gwen's book for $120. You can go to the bookstore. It's out. You can pick it up yourself. We would encourage you to do that. But if you'd like to join the station at that level, we're happy to say thank you with your very own copy.
Again, public radio is a project that we all work on together. Your dollars make it possible. About 60% of our support comes from people just like you who listen. Some of you may be in a position to give thousands of dollars. Some of you may be in a position to give dozens of dollars. It's really up to you to decide which. We really like the sustaining memberships because those sort of come from your checking account and you don't really even notice them every month. But please become a member or renew your membership right now, or perhaps give an additional gift. It will keep KERA strong. This station is a necessity and not a luxury. We know you understand that, but we ask that you confirm that by calling and making a contribution at 1-800-456-5372, or you can of course also do this online at kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is moderator and editor of PBS's Washington Week, Gwen Ifill. Her new book is called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. You can get a copy of that book with our compliments at the $120 membership level at 1-800-456-5372. If you want to talk to Gwen, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. This came up briefly earlier when we talked about Shirley Chisholm, Gwen, but the book also goes into this idea that there is still a glass ceiling for black women in politics.
Chris, I want to answer that question, but first I want to tell you how gratifying it is to be, as a PBS baby, to be part of Pledge.
Well, we appreciate your patience, but foreign a concept to you, is it?
No, it's not foreign at all, and I know how essential it is that people support public broadcasting, so trust me, that keeps me and you working. So,
yeah, exactly. Well,
so
thank
I love
you for
it.
That.
The interesting thing, when I started this book, I realized, I was struck by the fact that I was profiling chiefly four black men. And so I went on a hunt to see who the equivalents were, who were women, and I had quite a difficult time finding them. I did discover that the Speaker of the California House, Karen Bass, is African-American, and that was the first time that it ever happened. She's in her 50s. I did discover that the mayor of Atlanta, Shirley Franklin, is a black woman, and even though they'd had black men as mayor, and she's in her 60s. But as I looked for women, say, in their 40s who were of the same cohort, it was hard to find them. Kamala Harris, the district attorney in San Francisco, is. And you can look around and find a few, but not that many. So I started to ask why. And the best answer I came up with is that it's not so different from what limits women, gender, and women entirely in politics, which is a lot of the most powerful, most achieving women in politics are people who got into it after they raised their children. Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, after their children were adults, they felt free to pursue this kind of all-consuming task. In addition to that, I found out that a lot of women waited to be asked, waited to be recruited, hoped someone else would raise the money for them. And so there's some frustration among the groups which are out there recruiting women for office, but that's the reality, which is that if it is difficult for women in general to see their way clear to pursue families and pursue elected service, it is doubly difficult for women of color.
So if the assumption would be, Gwen, that women born in the 60s and 70s will probably be finished raising their kids within a decade or so, do you imagine an explosion of African-American women entering higher-level politics?
I would hope so, but I think there can only be an explosion if someone sets out to make it work. When you look at these male breakthroughs, all of them, as I mentioned before, stepped up because they decided it was their turn and nobody was going to get in their way. That's not a trait you find among a lot of women leaders. Even though the other side of this is that I think a lot of women choose to lead in other ways. They just don't choose politics. A lot of nonprofit groups are run by women, and you can see women breaking through on Wall Street and in the business world. There's just something about politics which requires putting yourself on the line, asking for money, asking for personal support, which women are less likely, not in general, and it's getting better, but often less likely to be in the leading edge.
What kind of example can or should Michelle Obama be setting? I mean, we all know First Lady is hardly a stay-at-home mother position, but this is a Harvard-educated lawyer who is currently not devoting herself to her first career.
I think she is hunting out what her role will be. So far, all we've heard is that she will work on behalf of military families, but I think she's still trying to figure out what she fits into. As we've seen with previous First Ladies, this is a minefield. Especially for women of accomplishment, how do you maintain the expected practicalities of the job? You know, people expect the First Lady to be the hostess. They expect her to pick the china, all of these, you know, pretty old-fashioned notions about what a First Lady is. And everybody remembers keenly that when Hillary Clinton tried to step out of that box, she was routinely derided for it when they talked about her being in charge of policy. People really resisted that. And the one thing that Laura Bush took pain to do was to say, hey, I'm just a little old librarian here on the side and I'm going to work on literacy programs, but it was not her instinct or desire to be far more out front than that. So I think that it's going to be interesting to watch Michelle Obama, who, as you pointed out, was quite an accomplished person in her own right before she stepped aside from her pretty high-powered career to support her husband. It will be interesting to see what kind of line she is able to walk and whether she has enough wind at her back and popularity along with her husband to be able to redefine the role.
Are people like Al Sharpton still relevant to black political culture?
They say so. And actually, I agree with them to this extent. Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, the people who have been, you know, widely considered to be quote-unquote leaders of the black community, a lot of people say, oh, goodness, this new breed means we can now push them aside. Well, they're not going anywhere because they think there's a real role for the loyal opposition. There's a role for people on the outside to pressure the people on the inside, whether those people happen to be African-American or not. Nobody believes for a moment that Barack Obama's ascension means everything's fine and hunky-dory in America when it comes to race or when it comes to people of color who suffer disproportionately on health care and on imprisonment, on all kinds of different issues. So these outsiders, as they were, outside agitators, still think there's a role to kind of hold government's feet to the fire to step up. And I would argue that's not a bad idea. Someone needs always to be held accountable.
I guess the second part to that question is were people like Jackson and Sharpton ever relevant to American politics outside of race?
Oh, yeah. I think they were very relevant. When I covered Jesse Jackson in 1988, as the campaign went on and he began to win more and more primaries, he really began to moderate his tone. People forget this now. He began to kiss a lot of white babies. He began to really reach out and really saw himself as a reasonable choice for Michael Dukakis as his vice president that year. He did not get it. Lloyd Benson got it. But he went to the convention with his Rainbow Coalition. He was kind of ahead of his time. The country now is truly more a rainbow. And they were speaking for a lot of disenfranchised people. I always thought it was interesting that Jesse Jackson was more like Pat Robertson, for instance, than people thought. When I went to the crowds at their rallies, I would see the same types of people would come out to support Jesse Jackson as coming out to support Pat Robertson, often very deeply culturally conservative churchgoers who didn't feel like anyone was speaking to their value set. In Jesse Jackson's case, they were often black, and in Pat Robertson's case, they were often white. But if you took that out of it, they were saying a lot of the same types of things, even though obviously they didn't agree on the same policies. But they were striking the same chord with voters who no one else was speaking to. So these outsiders, these agitators, are also always kind of necessary to keep the body politic healthy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. My guest is Gwen Ifill, and her new book is called The Breakthrough. We have an email from Paul in Terrell who asks if you can comment on President Obama's early training in the principles of community development derived from Saul Alinsky's work in Chicago.
I have to say, I wish I could really answer that question well, but I didn't write a book about Barack Obama on purpose. I knew a lot of people could write a lot about Barack Obama, about his history, about how he came to be. But I really set out to write a very narrow book about race and politics. And the degree that I write about Barack Obama in the book, it's in that context. It is in the context of how did he walk that tightrope? How did he get elected by walking that tightrope? But it's not a huge biographical take on everything he learned and everything he did. You have to kind of read another book to get to that.
Well, and I wonder if you think that one of a handful of different people could have been the Barack Obama of this year.
I don't think anybody else was quite there yet, partly because in order to get there, you have to be willing to step out. And there may be people out there who thought that this was their moment, but in the end, they didn't run. In the end, they didn't step up. In the end, they didn't have the resources. They didn't have the doggedness. They didn't have the built-in support that he ended up having. So I think he was fairly unique in that his time came and the moment and the man collided at the same moment. And even running against Hillary Clinton and beating Hillary Clinton was so remarkable in and of itself that I'm not sure I could name another candidate, black or white, who would have pulled it off.
So if the essence of breakthrough politics is essentially appealing to all voters on the same issues, the things that matter to all of us in similar ways, does that message of sameness ultimately, do you think, affect the way white voters and Latino voters think about their black neighbors and vice versa?
Well, probably. But in the end, I'm hoping it's not a message of sameness in the end, because politics of difference is important. We all do identify differently, and there's nothing wrong with it. The difference is, how do we see the difference? Do we see the difference as a negative, or do we see it as a positive? I had a writer, an emailer, ask me last week, why does it matter? Why can't we forget that Barack Obama is black? And my response was, why would we want to? That is, if that's part of who he is, if that's part of how he self-defines culturally as well as politically, why not accept it as a part of him and as a good thing? I think in this country we're used to talking about race in terms of conflict, and so we're not necessarily comfortable talking about race as a good positive. And that's when we try to erase race from the conversation. I don't think that we're there yet.
It's fascinating to consider the ramifications of this election because it says as much about white Americans or Americans who are not African-American of all different races as it does about African-Americans themselves in terms
Absolutely.
Of progress and ways of thinking. In other words, black voters have always had to cross racial lines to elect a president.
Absolutely, and always have been willing to, partly mm-hmm. because they are part of the minority, so that's what the choice was. But the bigger reach in an election year like this was for the majority to decide to support the minority. One of the reasons why Barack Obama's election was greeted with such astonishment abroad is because in so many countries they couldn't imagine. Can you imagine in France them electing an Algerian who had just immigrated to this country within this century? It wouldn't occur to them to do it. They wouldn't know how to handle that. And so they were stunned watching us do that. And it's one of the things that's unique about America, actually, and we're not a melting pot. We're, I think someone used to, I think David Dickens called it a mosaic or a quilt. We're all there. We all exist in these different little worlds, and occasionally, and more frequently now, we're crossing those lines to embrace what's good about the other.
Have we gotten beyond the point where if things do not go well in the Obama administration, white Americans will go back to thinking we can't consider an African-American president again?
I don't know. There is always that risk, I suppose. I like to think that we've really broken through in our psyches as well as in terms of the person, and that if Barack Obama should be a terrible failure, which he's got a tough job, he could always fail, that they won't say, oh, well, it's because he's black. I don't think so. I think he's laying the groundwork very purposefully so that they don't judge him by his race, they don't give him extra credit or take away from him because of his race, but that if he fails because he was not the right man at the right time, period.
My guest is Gwen Ifill. She's moderator and editor of Washington Week on PBS. Her new book is called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. We'll return to our conversation with Gwen in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also call us right now. Many, many lines are open at 1-800-456-5372. That is the telephone number to be part of the, it's not exactly a club, but of the community of people that bring public radio to North Texas and keep it strong and proud.
1-800-456-5372. Chris, I've been told that we can't not take a call. There is no way that we can.
It's not in our nature.
Miss a call.
If you're going to call with money, we absolutely will answer it whenever.
I think it's set up so as many people as call, we can handle it.
Let's test that.
At 1-800-456-5372. And of course, online, we haven't crashed the server yet. If you go online right now, you can check out the various thank you gifts. You can see a picture of the Think mug available. It's an 11-ounce black ceramic coffee mug. It's got the Think and KERA logos on it. You see it on the TV version of Think on Friday nights at 7:30, on Sunday mornings at 11:30. It's the very same design that our guests from Gene Wilder to Vicente Fox have consumed their on-set beverages out of. And you can have your very own version of it at the $60 membership level. Of course, if you join at the $120 membership level today, and really for the rest of the drive, honestly, we'd love to thank you with Gwen Ifill's book, a copy of her new book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama.
Such interesting reading. And she really gets back into a lot of the history that happened before this election. It's so easy to focus on what's happening right now, but she makes a great point of really laying the groundwork for how this country got to the place it is today, and also outlining the challenges that still exist. This is not all sunshine and rainbows. This also really looks at the conflicts within the black community as well as within America at large. Really great book. And if you want to get a copy anyway and you want to support KERA, it's perfect. Just make a $120 contribution or more and we'll send it to you. Call us at 1-800-456-5372.
Or join at any level and go to the bookstore and get your own copy because it's available in the bookstore as well.
We're not trying to trick you into thinking it costs $120.
Exactly. We you know, we're thrilled that Gwen has taken time out of her busy schedule to be on the show today. We're thrilled that we're getting the response we're getting from you. Really, honestly, folks, whatever it takes to get you to call, because our ultimate goal, and I say this a lot, and I will say this a lot this week during the drive, our ultimate goal is really just your participation, you. That one you who is listening right now, who listens to the station maybe just a few times during the week, maybe only around noon. Maybe you just tune in for Think, and we're thrilled to have you. But really, we really want to get you to take one more step and just send a little money to the station. Start small, start big, start however you want. Maybe you're a current member and you can give an additional gift right now because you love the station, because you use the service. It's worth it. We think it's worth it. That's why we come to work every day. A lot of you think it's worth it. How about you? 1-800-456-5372.
Think about the things that you spend your money on now. Think about what they say about who you are. You probably have many things that would say good things about you. We think a public radio membership really can define you in a way. And you know, you're happy to see that in your bank statement or your check register. 1-800-456-5372 is the number to call. We're closing in on $100,000 so far raised in this drive. Jeff really doesn't want to leave until... Well, he's been on the air since, what, 6 o'clock this morning?
6 o'clock, yeah.
He doesn't want to leave until we've got to at least $100,000. Think, listeners, we know that you're a hale and hearty crowd and always come through for us. And so you can inspire Jeff on this rainy Monday if you're going to make a contribution anyway. Give us a call now, 1-800-456-5372.
I think there are two kinds of public radio listeners, okay? There's the public radio listener who's never going to give no matter what. I mean, no matter what happens, there is a public radio listener who loves the station, and maybe they talk about it, maybe they don't talk about it. Maybe they just listen because they get something out of it, but they're never going to give. And then there's a public radio listener who is going to give someday. Now, maybe that someday was 20 years ago. Maybe you've been listening for 35 years, and you do plan to give at some point. But I feel like my personal goal is to get you to do that today. If you're going to give anyway someday, why not do it today? Do a $35 basic membership. Maybe you've listened for 35 years and you would like to, you know, sort of do a retro $100 a year, and you can join at the $3,500 level today. Whatever it is, go ahead and just make that step today. Because let's face it, eventually, if you're in that category, you're eventually going to give. Why not do it right now?
And you may surprise yourself by being an eventual person when you think you're a never-going-to-give person.
Right. Yeah, maybe so. And the number to call is 800-456-5372. The web address, maybe you're even listening online. If you're, I'm eventually going to give, so why not do it today, person, it's KERA.org.
We're not making any judgments here, but this is not like resisting the sales pitch for a timeshare. You know, this is a good thing to do. It's good to give in and let yourself become a member. You're not losing out. You know exactly what you're going to get because you get it every single day of the year, and you would be devastated if it were not here for you. We want to be here for you, and we plan to, but we need your support. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number to call. You can also go online to KERA.org. In just a moment, we will resume our conversation with the inimitable Gwen Ifill.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gwen Ifill. She's moderator and editor of Washington Week on PBS. Her new book is called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. If you want a copy and to support KERA, call us at 1-800-456-5372. If you want to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. That is where we find Mike in Fort Worth. Hi, Mike.
Yes, I had a question. I noticed that a lot of the politicians that Gwen talks about are Democrats, and I was just wanting to know how far behind the curve does she think Republican politicians are, because I don't know how long it's going to be before they're going to have, an African-American nominee.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, Mike. I, in addition to trying to find women, I went on the hunt for black Republicans as well and found that the Republican Party has actually lost ground in these last years. I remember a time when the Republican Party was talking about the big tent and trying to expand itself, certainly with an eye on the future and the future demographics. In fact, it slid backwards. It was a remarkably light, very few number of delegates at the Republican National Convention this summer. And even one of its leading lights, Michael Steele, who was the former lieutenant governor of Maryland, who actually now is running to be RNC chairman, he called it disgraceful, the way the party has basically not been recruiting and not building its presence in the black community and has ceded, in so many cases, the fight for the minority vote to the Democrats. I talked to a fellow for the book who's a young outreach director to minority communities named Shannon Rees for the Republican National Committee, and he admitted that he has a hard, hard job right now. Part of it, of course, this year was the Barack Obama phenomenon, but in general, he's having trouble recruiting Republican candidates at almost all these levels of government. This is something which the Republican Party's survival depends on. There are a lot of things about Republicanism that appeal to a lot of conservative blacks, but they have to feel like there's a home there. And right now, they're at a low point.
Which is interesting because it would seem to be the ideal time. If there's been, thanks to breakthrough politicians, sort of an evolution in the process by which African Americans can get political power in this country, not necessarily by aligning only with other African Americans, it would seem to be a freer time for black Americans to be Republicans.
And it may be. It may be. But someone's got to get out there and decide that it's a priority, that this recruiting, this building, this... I mean, the reason why Barack Obama won, I think, 64% of the Latino vote is not because he sat on his hands and said, I know they'll vote for me. He went out and worked for it, and they went out and recruited, and they went out and made some effort to reach into those communities. There was not a similar effort made on the Republican side in any communities of color, not that succeeded.
Are there potential pitfalls to a more racially homogenized political culture?
Certainly there are. I don't think we're anywhere close to homogenized at this point, but I mean, there's a lot of good. I really did like being on the National Mall last week and seeing people of all races, colors, creeds, ages, and caught up in kind of the same moment of excitement and history. On the other hand, there are things which are unique and specific to different communities, which we can hold dear unto ourselves without it necessarily taking away from the desire for all of us to kind of be hopeful and wishing for the success of any president at this time, no matter whether he was Republican, Democrat, black, white, or green. At some point, everybody has a certain patriotic fervor about hoping, at least in the beginning, no matter who the president is, that the president succeeds.
So, Gwen, how should we take this new reality into account when we're considering political districts and how they should be drawn?
Well, Chris, it's one of the interesting things. The first wave of power for a lot of these politicians came courtesy of very artfully drawn either congressional districts or state legislative districts, which were drawn sometimes in such elaborate ways as to carve out the biggest possible black vote and therefore get people into office. Now, redistricting only happens in many states once every 10 years, so it will take a while before that begins to shift. But I've had people who were architects of this approach now say, people who ran the Julius Chambers, who ran the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, say maybe we need to start rethinking that strategy in the age of Obama. So there is a lot of rethinking going on at every level of government and activism.
I suppose there's a sort of a hazard to deciding the moment at which we stop doing it this way.
Yeah, and I don't think it ever happens with one lightning stroke. It's a gradual. For instance, the fact that redistricting only happens when the census comes out tells you that this is a gradual thing. Nothing can happen all at once. But when you see something as startling historically as the election of Barack Obama, it does make you reexamine every other thing out there and say, is this the moment where it's all going to change?
An email from Rollins asks, as a woman of color yourself, what has been your most transcendent image or moment watching the racial and political evolution?
I have to say there have been a million of them, and it hits me usually off guard. You know, sometimes the day that the Obamas drove up to the White House to greet the Bushes for the first time, for some reason that image of them walking into the White House struck me. I don't know why. I can't explain exactly what it was. I just went, hey, look at that. When I was on the mall last week, I talked to a woman during the oath of office. As I looked at her, she fell to her knees and started crying. And when I asked her, you know, the dumb journalist question, how do you feel? She said she launched into a very eloquent description of how this day had affected her. She had traveled there from Tulsa, Oklahoma. She's an African-American woman. She was cold. And she said, at first I started crying about the cold, then I started crying about what I was seeing. And then she said, I have a little boy, and he doesn't have to be a rapper or an athlete. The sky's now the limit. And she was crying, and I was crying, you know. It was a moment. And so you look constantly for these moments along the way, and then you step back and say, how does this fit into the larger picture? I was really fortunate to be working in this book during this election campaign because it gave me a framework through which to view all the little bits and pieces that were shifting right in front of my eyes.
How stressful for you personally was the controversy over you working on the book at the time that you were about to moderate the vice presidential debate?
Well, you know, it's a pretty stressful thing to moderate presidential debate.
I can imagine.
So this was just a little cherry on top of all that stress. But I have to say that several things happened at the same time in my life. And one is that just before the debate, I fell and broke my ankle at home while preparing for the debate. And so I was mostly caught up with the idea that I was in a big splint, was going to have surgery, had to travel to St. Louis, ask all these questions, which I had prepared long before that happened. And then on top of it all, I discovered there was this kind of raging online debate about me. But, you know, that didn't really add additional stress because I was certain of a couple things. One is everything that everyone was saying about the book was not true. They were saying I was writing a pro-Obama book, and they hadn't really bothered to look and see. I was kind of hiding in plain sight that I was writing the book. It had been written about in several national publications. So it was not hard. It wasn't a secret. Plus, they didn't really want to know what it was about because it would have been easy to find out what it was about. So I decided there were people out there who needed the distraction for whatever reason, or alternatively trying to get in the moderator's head and rattle me a little bit. But I can honestly say I didn't change a single question before, after the controversy broke out that I had written before the controversy broke out. And it, as I suspected it would, it blew over the minute the debate was over because it was really, the point of it really was to rattle me. And it kind of didn't. And then the book came out, and now when anyone raises it, I just suggest that they read it.
So now you can pretty much take anything that's thrown at you.
We'll see. I'm not tempting anybody to throw anything.
Well, I wonder if it gave you a different perspective on some of the political figures that you cover that do get caught up in scandals, which may or may not be entirely grounded in fact.
Well, not really, because for me, it really was a very brief moment.
Yeah.
It was easily dismissed. Many of the political figures I've covered who get caught up in scandal, there's usually something else going on there. And for it to last more than a few days, mine lasted a few days. When it goes on for weeks and weeks, there is something more to find out. And not only that, but public officials are elected to serve people, and they have to be held accountable for the things they do and say. And if they have good answers to the questions that are raised, then it's our job to report them. I had good answers to the questions that were raised, and people chose to keep talking about it anyway. So you just roll with that.
So, Gwen, if we are not beyond race in America, where does it sit as a social phenomenon?
I think it just fits as part of who we are. We are alone. We're not alone, actually. We do have that unique burden. I think Condoleezza Rice calls it our national birth defect, slavery. And it's the thing that continues to taint a lot of our relationships and the way we think about race. The fact that Barack Obama is biracial speaks to about the race debate in a way that we've never really engaged in a public way before. It's healthy to talk about it. It's healthy to have an excuse to talk about it and to talk about what's different about it, what's good about it, what's bad about it, but then to move on, not to become obsessed by it or to use it to judge or reach conclusions about every single issue. If these breakthrough candidates are do what they look like they're doing, they're going to change the tone of the debate a little bit. Race will always be a factor. It will always matter, but it doesn't have to matter in a bad way. It might matter in a good way.
Exciting times.
Yeah.
Gwen Ifill is moderator and editor of Washington Week on PBS. Her new book is called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Gwen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. I also want to thank all of you who have called to participate, and especially those of you who are calling 1-800-456-5372. Perhaps you were waiting to hear the final word from Gwen Ifill before you picked up the phone or went online. Now that time has come. We have a room full of terrific volunteers that can get you started on your membership. If you had a membership a few years ago, they can even look you up and make sure that you get back with your same membership number if that happens to matter to you. We would love to welcome you back to the fold if you let things slide a while back. No rude comments here. We'll just be so happy to have you with us and on board. So give us a call now. Jeff Winnington is here. He's senior producer of Think.
Thanks, Chris. And thank you so much for listening today. Thank you so much for participating. Those of you who called in or emailed in during the show, that's what it's all about here at KERA, especially during the middays from noon to two. That's why we come to work every day, is to make a show that you find interesting, make a show that you want to get involved in the conversation, whatever the topic is. And many of you do, and we appreciate that. We would really love to hear from you if you get something out of this program, if you get something out of the station. We'd love to hear from you right now at 800-456-5372. It's 1-800-456-KERA or online at KERA.org. You can email us anytime, think@kera.org, but we would love for you to go on the website right now, click over to the support page, take a look at the thank you gifts, including Gwen Ifill's new book, The Breakthrough, and pick one or choose not to pick one, but give a gift of support to KERA.
Ron Kirk is in this book. Barbara Jordan is in this book. A variety of Texas figures, people that you'll find familiar, in addition to people that are working all around the country. And she has very big names, and she also has people who are working in local and regional politics. It's really a great thing to read. And again, we would love to give it to you. When you join us, with a $10 a month sustaining membership, that will qualify you to receive this as your thank you gift. Or you can make a larger gift and still choose this book. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. You are so dedicated to the station that you have brought your dad down here.
My dad's answering phones, yes, down the hall. Well, he's a huge supporter of the station. He's a listener. He likes to come and help out.
Mm-hmm. And if you would love to be down here, but somehow it doesn't work out, you can sort of feel just as much as if you're making a contribution by making a contribution.
And speaking of parentals, Chris Boyd,
how many Think Mugs do mom and dad have now?
If you so choose, you can follow Chris Boyd's parents' lead and get the quad set of matched Think Mugs for the $240 contribution.
Oh,
to the station.
And they got memberships for my kids to the station. Pretty soon, the family dog will have its own Think Mug.
800-456-5372 is the number to call. Online, you can do it at kera.org. It just takes a couple of minutes, and if you would like to fill out the pledge form yourself, then definitely go online and do it. It literally takes about 90 seconds, especially if you choose not to receive a thank you gift, to get all the information in there and your pledge goes through. We would really love for you to use your credit card or your debit card, because your dollars will go to work right away, helping the station pay for the programming that you listen to every day. That's the equation here. The more listeners we have listen to KERA in the Dallas-Fort Worth, fifth media market in radio in the country, the more we have to pay, because it's set up that way through NPR. Your dues are based on what your listenership is. We're thrilled to have you as a listener, but we really would love for you to help pay for the cost, to help offset all the costs that go into making this radio station a success.
Think about the other things that you consume that are both entertainment and information, and how many hours a day or a week you spend consuming them. And then think about the money that you spend on those. And I would venture to say that you spend more time with KERA than is reflected by the money that you spend with KERA. You get to choose the amount that you want to spend being a member of the station, but it really does reflect your values. And we can't say it enough times. We're not talking to the person next to you. We're talking to you. And at some point, when you become a member, you just think, well, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. I am part of the cost of running the station. Therefore, I should be part of the solution to keep it going.
And our engineers have not yet figured out how to make the radio station not work for those of you who don't support the station financially. And even if they did, we wouldn't do it, because part of the reason for this service, part of the reason for public radio, is that it's there for everyone, regardless of whether a listener can afford, or regardless of whether they choose willingly to support the station. It's still there. And even if someone who's never going to join the station gets something out of it, maybe gets informed or gets an idea or changes their mind about something one way or the other because of something they heard on KERA, then the service has achieved its goal. Our goal, however, is to try to convince that person, and maybe that person is you, to support it at whatever level is affordable, $60, $600, you decide, but please decide to call 800-456-5372.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth-Denton, and online at kera.org. Our telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. We are here because listeners make us exist. We wouldn't have enough money. We would not have enough money, I'll say that again, if we relied only on major corporate funders and people that come in and do underwriting. They are very important, but they are not enough to keep the station going.
Over half the revenue necessary to run this operation comes directly from listeners, comes directly from people who have decided that it's worth some money. There are all kinds of thank you gifts when you choose to join the station, but the best gift is probably the fact that you will know that you've done your part, that you will know that every time you turn the radio on, you'll hear your dollars at work, your dollars blended and coupled with the dollars of all the thousands of people who are going to support the station during this drive and this year, really goes a long way to provide this service. It's unbelievable how rich it can be when everyone who is going to get involved gets involved at 800-456-5372.
And we haven't mentioned this today, or at least I haven't, but the Member Rewards Card is still an entity out there. It still gets you amazing discounts. I would absolutely say it can easily pay for itself. Even if you're giving $20 or $30 a month to the station, the Member Rewards Card, if you go to enough arts and entertainment organizations that are listed on there, get enough discounts, it pays for itself.
Yeah, and you can get that when you join at any level over $35. Folks, we raised, thanks to you, $94,200 so far in this membership campaign. Please do your part right now, and we can end the drive that much earlier. The phone number again is 800-456-5372.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.